We're finishing up our study of King Hezekiah, and we've been looking at quite an abundant amount of information that God gives us about him and the time of his reign over Judah as king, and we've seen from all the good that he did from the outset of his reign as he was seeking God and to set things in the proper order again in the kingdom of Judah, and all that he did from the very beginning of his reign and calling the people of Judah back to God, and even the efforts that he made to reach out to the ones that were left of the children of Israel in the northern kingdom until their fall. Then we saw how after the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, then of course they turned to Judah and came through their land, and then the Lord saved Hezekiah and Jerusalem and Judah and in a great manner in turning back the Assyrians. And this magnified God and also made Hezekiah famous throughout that part of the world. Then he fell sick, and the Lord was prepared to take his soul to eternity as he was prepared for eternity. He pled with the Lord to restore his health, and God did, gave a great miraculous sign through Isaiah the prophet and turning the shadow of the sun back 10 degrees to show that he was going to fulfill that in giving Hezekiah healing from his sickness and adding 15 years to his life, which he did. Then we saw after that happened, the Babylonians sent the king of Babylon, Merodach-Baladan, sent servants to Hezekiah in Jerusalem, sending him presents, having heard that he had been sick. And Hezekiah responded then by showing all that he had to the Babylonians that were there. And we see that he had fallen to the temptation of pride, that the devil was able insert some pride into his heart, and he fell to a temptation of showing all of those things. And he was obviously, as the Lord said, that he had been lifted up there in pride. His heart was lifted up, it said in 2 Chronicles 32 and verse 25. At that time then, Isaiah the prophet was sent by the Lord to rebuke Hezekiah. He repented. He humbled himself. God determined a punishment for that that sin that he fell to, all of those, all of the goods of the king's house that he had showed the Babylonians, he said, everything that is here in Jerusalem of all of those things that you showed all the Babylonians, all these things, they're going to come and take all these things one day. But it would not be in Hezekiah's days because he had humbled himself. So God deferred when that punishment was going to occur. But it would. And also he said that the king's, the royal seed, the king's descendants, would be made eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. So those were all the things that we read, and so this takes us up to near the end of what God tells us about Hezekiah and his reign. And we've seen a lot in 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, as well as the book of Isaiah about him. So we do want to try to finish up what we have not covered yet of in our study of these things in those chapters concerning Hezekiah. to go and do that. In 2 Kings chapter 20, where we've been most recently, when Isaiah came to Hezekiah and asked him who those men were, and Hezekiah told him that they were come from a far country, even from Babylon, in verse 14 of 2 Kings 20. And Isaiah then asked him, "What have they seen in your house?" And Hezekiah answered, "All the things that are in my house have they seen. There is nothing among my treasures that I have not showed them." And Isaiah said unto Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord. Behold, the days come that all that is in thine house and that which thy fathers have laid up in store unto this day shall be carried into Babylon. Nothing shall be left, saith the Lord. And of thy sons that shall issue from thee, which thou shalt beget, shall they take away, and they shall be eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon." Then said Hezekiah unto Isaiah, "Good is the word of the Lord which thou hast spoken." And he said, "Is it not good if peace and truth be in my days?" And the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and all his might, and how he made a pool and a conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Judah? And Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and Manasseh his son reigned in his stead. Now that follows what we read almost word for word there in the book of Isaiah, where we were finishing up there last Sunday morning. But Hezekiah pronounced that it was good that what God had spoken, and that peace and truth would be in his day. So that's in reference to the fact that God said that he was not going to bring to pass that punishment in Hezekiah's time. Now, when we turn to 2 Chronicles 32, and I know we've read some of these verses previously, but to refresh on that, it tells us the reason why God deferred the punishment that he was going to bring upon Judah and Jerusalem for that sin, the pride that it wasn't just Hezekiah, of course, that fell to that temptation there. As we read in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 previously, it says in verse 25, "But Hezekiah rendered not again according to the benefit," which that word means the treatment that was done unto him, of course, by God, which was good treatment, the blessing that God gave to him in saving him from the Assyrians, and also then to save his life and extend his days. And it says, "For his heart was lifted up. Therefore there was wrath upon him and upon Judah and Jerusalem." So were the people of Judah and Jerusalem also, did they fall to that temptation when suddenly they became the center of worldwide attention and praise? Well, they did, obviously. It says so. So there was wrath from God upon all of them for that. So Hezekiah was not the only one that was given that temptation, but he got caught up in it also. So it says there that his heart was lifted up, which is Gaba, the Hebrew word there, which is 1361 by the Strong's numbering. It's a word we've seen before, and it means literally to soar. And it is used like that sometimes in reference to like what we would think of when a bird might soar in the heavens, in the sky. It is used in that way, but it's also used here in this sense of when a heart can soar, be lifted up. Now, by itself, is there more than one way in which a heart can be lifted up? When we see, if it says somebody's heart is lifted up, does that automatically mean it's a bad thing that's lifted up in pride? Well, no, we've seen this word before in reference to Jehoshaphat in 2 Chronicles chapter 17 and verse 6. If we can just look at that again very quickly, just to remind ourselves how these words are used. There's a good way for our hearts to be lifted up, and there's a bad way. Jehoshaphat's heart was lifted up in a good way that he's describing here in 2 Chronicles 17, verse 6. It says, "And his heart was lifted up in the ways of the Lord. Moreover, he took away the high places and groves out of Judah." Well, was Hezekiah's heart also lifted up in the ways of the Lord in what we have read about him up to this point after he fell to this particular temptation that we're reading about now? Well, yes. So what he's describing of Jehoshaphat was certainly applicable to Hezekiah also, but there he's using that very same word. But our hearts can either be lifted up in the ways of the Lord. That's a good way for our hearts to soar in God's ways. The other way is what happened to Hezekiah. Our hearts can be lifted up and soar in what way? Well, it tells us very plainly there back in 2 Chronicles 32, after he used that word, that his heart was lifted up. In what? Verse 26 says, "Notwithstanding, Hezekiah humbled himself for the pride of his heart." So there he tells us very plainly, his heart was lifted up in what? In pride. Well, we can either have our hearts lifted up in the ways of the Lord, we can have our hearts lifted up in pride, in our own ways. Now, does that mean our hearts are going to be lifted up one way or the other? How about just kind of being, well, how many people are not going to be have pride? How common is that? So it would be very difficult to see somebody who's not having a pride problem. He's not, when he's using a word like that, can we be a follower of the Lord but not really have our hearts lifted up in his ways? Can that happen? Well, we could be lukewarm. We could have from having that zeal, we can lose that and become lukewarm. That's not going to be our hearts heading in the right direction. Hezekiah fell to a temptation, though. We need to be on guard of that, which is a major point of this study, as we see Hezekiah being someone who was formed in what is good, his heart was perfect. So he had grown spiritually to the point where God was ready to take him to eternity. But then when he was given that additional time on the earth, he was going to have to deal with more temptation. And this was the one that came. And he fell to it. And it could have cost him his soul, except he did humble himself and repent of it. But, he fell to a sin that he wouldn't have fallen to if he had died from that sickness. He wouldn't have fallen to this sin. He would have been gone from the earth. So there was the risk to his soul staying here longer, as it would be for any of us. If as long as we're here, we have that that threat from our adversary, the devil. So at what point can we ever, while we're in this life, let our guard down and not be vigilant and sober in looking out for our adversary and the devil and his devices and his wiles that he's going to be using to try to lift our hearts up in pride or any other way that he can cause us to fall to temptation. We can never stop being on guard. If we at any point stop that, then, I mean, what's almost certain to happen? We're going to fall to some temptation. So this should be a reminder to us, no matter how strong we've grown, we've still got to be very vigilant and sober and careful in all things, and look for the ways in which the devil is going to be coming after us to tempt us. And he was subject to God's wrath because of that, and a punishment came. It's interesting to see, and there are lots of examples, and it's very interesting when we look at when God metes out a punishment for whatever trespass someone has fallen to, whether it's an individual or a nation like his people Israel. But it's interesting to see how God designs his punishments and how his ways are, how they are equal. God is fair and righteous in his judgment. For example, when the children of Israel, after all the murmuring that they did, and then finally, when the spies went into Canaan and they returned, and the people listened to the 10 spies that had no faith and did not listen to Caleb and Joshua, in fact, were ready to stone them, and they wanted to appoint a captain to lead them back to Egypt, and they said, because our children are going to be made a prey. We've been led out here into the wilderness for all this to now be entering the land of Canaan, so our children are going to be killed by all these giants and strong people in Canaan. So what did... And that was after the spies had been in the land for 40 days and 40 nights. Well, Moses, the Lord was ready to destroy all of those people for that were caught up in that. Moses pled for them. God determined a punishment. What was it? Yes. You say these children are going to be a prey. You're going to be the prey. They're going to go in. You're not. So that was part of it. And then he also sentenced them a year for a day for the spies the time they were in Canaan. So they were in there 40 days. So they were sentenced to wander in the wilderness 40 years, which would give ample time for that generation to die out. Not all of them of natural causes. There were many, many plagues that occurred during that period of time. When they did other things to provoke the Lord, they were going to all be gone, that generation, by the time that 40 years was over, and their children did enter the land of Canaan. But it's interesting to see how God chose and designed that particular punishment for what was done there. There are lots of examples of things of that nature. Well, this is another good one here. Hezekiah is lifted up in pride and shows all the stuff that he has to the Babylonians. So what's the punishment? The Babylonians are going to take all the stuff one day. Because Hezekiah humbled himself in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 and verse 26, both he and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, it says, so that the wrath of the Lord came not upon them in the days of Hezekiah. So that's the reason God determined to defer the punishment. Do we have other examples of God doing that, where he had determined to do something, but then he decided to delay that punishment coming into effect in terms of its timing because of humility shown on the part of whoever was the guilty one? What's that? Ahab, that's certainly one that should come to mind there. When Ahab, and he was one of the most wicked people that we read about in all of God's Word. When God sent Elijah the prophet to him and told him of the destruction that was going to come upon all of his family. When he heard that, what did he do? He put on sackcloth and he went softly. He didn't repent of all of his sins and turn to the Lord, but the Lord even responded to that much humility shown by Ahab under the circumstances that he said, because he humbled himself to that degree, that God determined he was going to defer the that punishment of Ahab's house until after Ahab died, which would not be of natural causes either, because God had already determined what was going to happen to him because of what he did to Naboth and taking his vineyard. The dogs were going to lick up Ahab's blood in the very spot where Naboth had been murdered there in Jezreel, and that's what happened. And so he died at in that battle at Ramoth-Gilead. But it was only after that that God brought the destruction of his family, which tells us if he had, if he hadn't done that, if he hadn't humbled himself like that, then God was going to bring that destruction on the house of Ahab. He would have brought it to pass in Ahab's time. And Ahab would have seen that, and then he would have died. But God changed the timing of it because of that token of humility that he showed there. So we've seen that before, and that was what he did for a wicked man. Well, here's a very righteous man, and he's humbled himself and obviously repented of it. So God determined that he was not going to bring it to pass during Hezekiah's days. It would delay the timing of the punishment, but it was not going to make it go away. God was going to punish that sin. Another example of the principle or the point that repentance from sin does not guarantee a removal of all consequences. And we all do that. We all desire that. From when we're little children and we know we're in trouble for something, and then we want to say, well, I'm sorry, and then we don't want any punishment to come. Well, I mean, we've all done that from the time of being a little children, but that desire doesn't really change much, does it? If we do something wrong, we would like to not have to be able to, we don't want to wait till we're caught, but in any event, we would like to not have to suffer the punishment if we realize what we've done wrong, that we can evade that. But is that always going to be the case, that if we repent of something, that we're going to be spared all consequences from it? No, that's not, God doesn't promise that we will escape any consequences. Now, if we've repented, are we going to be punished in eternity for that? We have his promise of forgiveness then, but that doesn't mean that there's not going to be any consequences in this life. This is an example that God did bring punishment. And can other people end up suffering as part of those consequences for something that somebody else did? Is that the same thing as the father's eating sour grapes and the children's teeth being set on edge, the proverb that the children of Israel were using in Ezekiel 18, when they were saying, here we are over in Babylon, we're being punished for our father's sins, which wasn't true. They were being punished for their own sins, for one thing. So their whole idea of claiming to be innocent was false. But that proverb itself was false. And the rest of Ezekiel 18 is teaching how God does not punish for the guilt, hold an innocent person and hold them as guilty of something that they didn't do, that they're that their father did. So if there's a wicked man and his son is righteous, is God going to charge him with the sins of the father? Which, what does that do with the entire doctrine of so-called original sin that says we're born stained, depraved and stained with the sin of Adam? That's the basis of why certain denominations practice, well, they call it infant baptism, even though they don't immerse a baby, but they sprinkle water on them. But why do they even go through that with a baby? Because that's based on that doctrine of original sin. They're stained with Adam's sin then, so even before they've done anything wrong themselves or can understand anything, then they're doing this to try to cleanse them from the guilt of Adam's sin. Well, how's that any different than the principle that we read in Ezekiel 18, that proverb that the children of Israel were using? And God doesn't do that. What does he say in Romans 5:12 concerning us and Adam? Well, Adam sinned and died, and he says, and so death is passed upon all men, not because Adam sinned, but he says, for all have sinned. So we suffer separation from God based on our own sins, that spiritual death. That's the wages of sin. Are we born separated from God because Adam sinned or somebody else did? No. We suffer the wages of sin when we sin. Now, does that mean if somebody else sins that it will have no effect on us, that we can't suffer any adverse consequences because of something that somebody else has done wrong? Well, what's the second sin that we read about in the Bible? Well, that's going to beg the question, what's the first one? Obviously, when Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What's the second sin that we read about in the next chapter in Genesis 4? Cain and Abel. And as part of that, could we ask the question, did Abel suffer any consequences of Cain's sin, falling to the temptation to commit murder? Abel was innocent. Cain committed murder. Did that affect Abel? Very much so. Anytime anybody kills or if they do anything violent, stealing. I mean, if somebody steals something, somebody got stolen from, right? Does that affect the person who's the victim of the thief? In fact, how easy is it to find a sin that somebody can commit that's not going to hurt somebody else? That's the entire reason why, what is the framework in terms of the greatest commandments and what all the other commandments hang upon? Number one is to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. If we start with that, are we then, if we love God so that if we love Him, we'll keep His commandments, and He commands us to love our neighbor as ourselves, are we going to obey that commandment if we really love God like we should? Yes, so that's where it starts. But the second commandment is that we love our neighbor as ourselves. And all the other commandments hang upon that. Romans 13, when he brings up that situation again where he says, love works no ill to his neighbor. And then he lists many of the Ten Commandments there that are right there included as part of the new covenant, but it's based on that commandment to love one another. And love doesn't work ill to our neighbor, and so those commandments of thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, those commandments hang upon that commandment to love one another, because if we commit any of those sins, we're hurting somebody else. And that's why all the other commandments hang upon those two, because just about anything else, If we do wrong, we're going to be hurting somebody in some way. Even today, I mean, you go back to what happened during the time of the flood. That changed everything as far as how the earth works, weather, climate, all of that. I mean, the way the earth was watered when there was that canopy of waters above the earth, and there was the firmament that separated the waters from the waters above from the waters below the sea and all of that. The mist came up from the ground and watered the whole earth. So that was, but that change with the flood, what happened to that canopy of waters that once was above the earth? It was gone. But that was the first rain. And Hebrews 11 mentions that Noah believed God in things that hadn't been seen yet. God told him it was going to rain and flood. That hadn't happened yet. So that, and after that, since then, now, we have a completely different situation on the earth, as we don't have that those waters above anymore. If we had that, then what would the climate be like on the earth? It would be a lot more mild, yes, very much so. And you wouldn't have all the weather patterns that we have. So we have, I mean, with the, we have the, all of the weather patterns with the winds and the seasons and everything generated as a result of that, that big change that occurred. Storms, the things that we have with thunderstorms, tornadoes, hurricanes, and all of that. Did that exist before? No, but do we deal with consequences of those kinds of things on earth today? Certainly so. I mean, does anybody on earth today deal with any kind of consequences that go back to all those sins that were on the earth back in Noah's time? Yeah, we do. Are there still any curses for men and women that go back as consequences for what Adam and Eve did? I mean, yes. By the sweat of our brow we labor, men. Women still have the, and even with epidurals and all that, there's no way to remove all the discomfort of childbirth, is there? So there are those things that we bear. We're not being charged with the guilt of those sins, but we do suffer certain things as a result of what others have done. And there's so many other examples of that. Well, the people in the generations to come, so it would start the time of Josiah's sons. So this was going to be about 100 years into the future from Hezekiah when these events that we're reading about now, when the punishment would actually come into effect. And I mentioned this last week, but if we can very quickly turn over to Daniel chapter 1 just to look at the beginning of the chapter to see how this ties into that punishment where God said all those the things that were in the king's palace would all go to Babylon. I mean, there are a lot of verses that tell about that and how they took all of the stuff out of Jerusalem and from the Lord's house as well, and it got carried away to Babylon. But as far as the seed royal being made eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon, the book of Daniel begins, chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels unto the treasure house of his God. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of his princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well favored and skillful in all wisdom and cunning and knowledge and understanding science, and such as had ability in them to stand in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine that he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might stand before the king. Now among these were of the children of Judah, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that were renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So what is where they were of? What does it say there? And they were made eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. These were of the royal seed. That was direct fulfillment. It doesn't mention that there in Daniel 1, but it was. We know that because that's what God said was going to happen. He deferred that from Hezekiah's time, so it was about 100 years later, but it happened in that reign of Jehoiakim when that began. Josiah's son. So after Hezekiah, there was going to be Manasseh and then Amon and then Josiah. And so this would be the fourth generation to Jehoiakim after Hezekiah. So 100 years, and that would be his son, grandson, his great-great-grandson during his time. So it was going to affect Hezekiah's descendants 100 years later, and it happened. But it was delayed because of Hezekiah humbling himself at that time. It tells us there then, starting in verse 27, of the riches that Hezekiah had. So this is really showing where it came from God. But then Hezekiah got lifted up in pride, and he was showing all this to the Babylonians. But verse 27 here in 2 Chronicles 32 says, "And Hezekiah had exceeding much riches and honor, and he made himself treasures for silver and for gold and for precious stones and for spices and for shields and for all manner of pleasant jewels, storehouses also for the increase of corn and wine and oil, and stalls for all manner of beasts and coats for flocks. Moreover, he provided him cities and possessions of flocks and herds in abundance, for God had given him substance very much. This same Hezekiah also stopped the upper watercourse of Gihon and brought it straight down to the west side of the city of David. And Hezekiah prospered in all his works." So he did a lot of things during his reign. And God blessed him greatly. And not only did Hezekiah prosper, but this we can see there with the things that he did and how God made him to prosper in all his works. That benefited all the others under him in Judah and Jerusalem. What he did with the water courses and all those other things. So God blessed Hezekiah and the works of his hands. Then verse 31 tells us a key, and this is something this is going to help us to understand exactly what was going on. We could ask the question, why didn't God just give Hezekiah 15 more years here and spare him all the temptation since he was ready for eternity anyway? That's not the way God operates. If we want to understand, and we should, how God works, we can read this in verse 31. It says, "Howbeit in the business of the ambassadors of the princes of Babylon, who sent unto him to inquire of the wonder that was done in the land, God left him to try him, that he might know all that was in his heart." There's the explanation, and that's the work that God is doing. And as long as we're here on this earth, as long as God keeps us here, this is what God's going to be doing with each and every one of us. God is going to be searching our hearts. Did he know Hezekiah's heart? Yes. But he kept searching it. He obviously... And God is... the devil is... He's eager and willing to do all the works that he does and tempting us and to do evil and trying to destroy us. Well, God is the one that gives him permission to do those things. And in that way, God is actually using Satan to enable God to do his own work of searching the hearts of all of us. Because it's when we are faced with temptation, is God observing things in our hearts and seeing more that's in our hearts based upon how we respond to whatever that temptation is? And that searching process keeps going on. And so even though God was ready to take him, now he's given him more time. Now he's putting Hezekiah into more situations, different situations, seeing what he's going to do in response to that temptation as he is searching his heart more and more. So when does God stop? When does he lose interest in what's in our hearts? God is, look how interested he is in every aspect of our hearts, in what's in there, that he is searching us in that way. How much interest do we have in our own hearts? How much interest do most people have in their own hearts? They show very little, don't they? If any. They just float by day to day, moment to moment, without really giving any thought to what's there. Of course, what is in our hearts is going to have everything to do with ultimately where we spend eternity. So it's another way of asking. I mean, how many people really are thinking on a daily basis or a moment-to-moment basis about what's coming in eternity and being prepared for that? That obviously goes together, but people don't think about that. They don't want to think about that. But it's coming anyway. And so is it to our benefit to be concerned about our eternity and therefore about what's in our hearts spiritually? Well, that should seem to be very obvious to us that is something that is very crucial for each and every one of us, and as such, we need to be searching our own hearts and seeking to understand what's in ourselves. In Proverbs chapter 20, verse 24. He says, man's goings are of the Lord. How can a man then understand his own way? Well, that's an interesting question. It's very difficult, isn't it? But what makes, do we have any desire to understand our own way? Why am I doing this? Why did I do that? Why did I say that? Why did I respond that way in that situation? I mean, do we ask ourselves those kinds of questions? Do we think about that? Do we search into that? And what it's going to come down to is what we say, what we do, all of that comes from what source? Our hearts. The very thing that God is searching in us. And as we know, our inward part is our spirit is God's candle to be searching us. And that's what he's doing. And he was continuing to do that with Hezekiah. Well, the Lord is the one that, and it says that the Lord tried him so that he would know all that was in his heart. And that is the word for test. That doesn't mean that God tempted him with evil. God doesn't do that, as we know from James 1:13. But God does give us tests. In those tests, the devil is the one that's tempting us, enticing us to do evil. God's the one encouraging us to do what's good, and to obey him. But based on what we do in that, God's going to be searching our hearts concerning those things. Well, the situation, I mean, how many situations do we find ourselves in a given day? A lot. And how much of those were things that we were expecting or planning or anticipating? Well, for example, what's that? Yeah, probably not the majority of them. Well, for example, I mean, I had absolutely no thought whatsoever last night when I went to bed that I was going to be waking up at 2:45 this morning with my smoke alarm going off in my house. And I found myself in a situation. I wasn't expecting that. But there we are. So I was up in the wee hours then, unexpectedly, and I was in a situation that I was not planning on. The house is okay, but anyhow, things like that happen. We're suddenly confronted with a situation, and those things happen all the time. And we're just here. We are. We have some plans of what we're. Here's what we are planning to do, but how much of what we have in our minds is going to happen is the way it goes? And how many things come up in a given day that we didn't think about or anticipate at all? Like Michael says, it's really the majority, by far, of what we face. We're not thinking about that's what's going to happen. Well, who's the one that is casting the lot into our lap in all those situations? Who's the one steering this car, so to speak? Who's the one that's directing where we're going? It's the Lord, and that's his point there, that man's goings are of the Lord. How can a man then understand his own way? Well, it's very difficult, but what we have to do is search concerning what happens to us in those situations that we are put into by the Lord, moment to moment, day to day, and that gives us an opportunity to search ourselves, to see our own way, and what we did, we can learn a lot about what we need to work on. Well, Hezekiah, with what happened to him, he was put into that situation there when he doesn't tell us the answer to this, but what are the chances that Hezekiah, after he fell sick, that he was thinking there as he recovered, I bet the king of Babylon is going to be sending a bunch of guys over here, and thinking that that situation was going to confront him very soon. I would venture that it's very unlikely that he was anticipating that particular situation coming. Well, they showed up. There they are. And he's in that situation, and he responds to it by, here they come, and they are obviously being used by the devil to fill him with pride. And that is the real point of that we cannot ever stop doing that. We have to live that way constantly, because we're not going to know what's coming next. It's rare that we do. We're confronted with things. Here it is. And here's a temptation. We can go this way, which isn't good, or we can do the right thing. I mean, that's... Luke 4, that account of when Jesus was in the wilderness and the devil brought those temptations upon him when he was out there for those 40 days. Did he know ahead of time each specific temptation that was going to come before him there? Or did the devil present him with those temptations, and then did Jesus have to respond to it to then consider, here's what my Father has said, and then had that shield of faith, quench that dart, and then confronted with the next one? I mean, that's the way it went. But he had done the work. He had prepared his heart with all of that diligent seeking, and so he knew his Father's commandments, and so he was ready for it from that, and he was vigilant, circumspect, and he was looking all around. So when the temptation came, he was ready for it. But that's our example, our greatest example to follow there, where Hezekiah had an opportunity when that came, when he showed all those things, to think, oh, he could look at his heart and say, I developed some pride in that situation and fell to it. And it would appear that he obviously did that because he humbled himself from that. He repented of it. But we need to understand that is God's work. that God is going to be testing us to know all that is in our heart. So how's he going to do that? By putting us in how many different situations? That's the same word, by the way, that's in Genesis 22:1 for when it says he tempted Abraham when he told him to offer his son Isaac for a sacrifice. So that was the test that he was given there. He was putting Abraham in these different situations. He'd already put him through a lot. And how much of Abraham's heart did he already know? I mean, we can read in, it's in Genesis 18, where God said, I know him, and what he, that he was going to, how he was going to teach his children the Lord's ways. He knew what was in the heart of Abraham, and so he wasn't going to withhold from him what he was planning to do there at Sodom and Gomorrah. But God said he knew him. He knew the heart of Abraham. How many situations had he already put Abraham through at that point? We read about many of them that we're told to learn from and follow as examples of his faith and what he overcame when he was told to leave his own family and his land and to go to Canaan, and when he was given those promises of God that he didn't stagger at through unbelief, and so many situations. But God had many more, and then he gave him that test of offering his son Isaac, and he passed that test, as we know. But that's what God was doing with Abraham, putting him in those situations as tests to learn more about what was in his heart. And from that, he says, now I know that he will not withhold his own son. Well, did he? What was the way he could find out for certain that Abraham would not, that he would maintain his faith before God, that God was going to fulfill all of his promises that he had made anyway, and that he wouldn't disobey even that commandment of his? Well, he put him in that situation, gave him that test, and he found, he saw that in Abraham's heart. Well, that's what he was doing. That's what he does with all of us. And that searching didn't stop when he gave additional time to Hezekiah. That gave God 15 more years to be searching Hezekiah. How many other tests did he go through during that 15 years that we don't read about here? A lot. And we know that he's telling us what God was doing through all of that time. But that's what he's doing with us as well. So we need to be searching our own hearts in all these situations too, to learn about ourselves and what we need to be working on, and to give ourselves to God, to let him work on as the potter with our clay of our hearts to form us. Last two verses of 2 Chronicles 32, verses 32 and 33 says, now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his goodness, behold, they are written in the vision of Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, and in the book of the kings of Judah and Israel. And Hezekiah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the chiefest of the sepulchers of the sons of David. The chiefest of all. We can understand why. All Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem did him honor at his death, and Manasseh his son reigned in his stead. So that brings us to the end of the reign of and life of Hezekiah, and Manasseh is another one that we can learn a lot from. Very different, but we can learn a lot from him too. So Lord willing, we'll start looking at Manasseh and his reign next Lord's Day.